Nonetheless, I have two recorders here just to make sure that I can end up with this vitally important talk up on my webpage at almost zero marginal cost. My first serious academic position in economics was at the Public Choice Center at BPI at a time when the two major figures there were Gordon Tullock and Jim Buchanan. And it therefore seems to me particularly appropriate that I'm giving two talks here where they eventually fled to after various adventures, of which the one tomorrow is ideas that were largely my response to Jim's review of my first book, which was the one intelligent review it received, meaning the one review that actually made me think. Whereas this talk involves ideas that were in a certain sense inspired by Gordon Tullock. To put it more precisely, Gordon published an article which provided me with the opportunity of arguing that something that Gordon had said was both obvious and false. And any of you who know Gordon will understand that that was a temptation I could not resist. And so a set of ideas came out of that particular situation. Those of you who've read the paper will have a clearer idea of that. The other person, though, I ought to mention is the late Earl Thompson, because he was the person who really convinced me of the importance of thinking about commitment strategies. And was a very smart and very odd person whose political views were the opposite of all the rest of ours, but who nonetheless could do quite a convincing job of, a magically convincing job of defending them. That's another story which I will tell on some other occasion. But the talk I'm giving today really has to do with two different conceptual puzzles. One of them is what gives you civic order? What does civic order consist of? That we've all read the story of the Hobbesian state of nature and how terrible it is. And the question is, why aren't we in it? If we sort of look around, what is the difference between this world, the underlying difference between this world and the world Hobbes describes, which explains why we aren't all killing each other and why the life of man is not nasty, brutish, and short. I think I left out an adjective somewhere. Doesn't matter.
Solitary.
Poor and solitary, thank you. So I think I have an answer to that question. I think I have an answer to what we have that they don't have. And I think I also have, related to that, an answer to another question, which is a question that I actually started worrying about when I was writing Machinery of Freedom about 40 years ago, roughly. And that's the question of what is the state? What is the government? That there are lots of organizations that do the same things as governments do, right? Our government at various points delivers the mail, runs hospitals, does all sorts of things that are also done privately. You might say, well, the government is the only thing that goes around enforcing rules or using force, but that obviously isn't true. If you actually look around you, there are lots of legal or illegal uses of force not by government. Government doesn't really have a monopoly over the use of force, though it may pretend to. So it's a real puzzle. Why do we call some criminal gangs, and some organizations that, like criminal gangs, use force to make people do what they want, governments? And I think I have an answer to that question. I had the answer in an insufficiently thought-through version when I published Machinery of Freedom, and I think I can now fill out what that answer was. So let me start with the idea of selling points. How many people here are already familiar with the idea of selling points? Right. I assume most audiences aren't, but this audience is more likely to than most. Thomas Schelling thought of the idea of what are sometimes called focal points as an explanation of how humans coordinate their activities. And the original story he tells, as I remember in the article that started all of this, is that he separately speaks with two students in, I think, his office at Yale or Princeton, or at Yale is where he was at the time, and he makes the following deal. He says, I will give you $100 if you can arrange to be in the same place at the same time in New York City tomorrow as the other guy who I'm going to talk to in half an hour. You may not communicate with each other between now and then. I don't know if he really did this, but it's just a Gedanken experiment, as we physicists say. And the question is, how do they solve that problem? And the way they are going to solve that problem is to say, any meeting place which could just as easily be 6 other meeting places we are unlikely to coordinate on. So where is there a point in New York City that is unique from the standpoint of both of us? When I originally heard the problem, my first thought was the top of the Empire State Building, tallest building in the world at the time. But I discovered there is no such place, that there are 4 different observation decks spaced around the Empire State Building. So if they had come up with my poor idea, they would only have had 1 chance in 4 of winning. They actually met, or at least this is how he tells the story, under the clock at Grand Central Station. That was, to both of them, a unique place in New York City. And then the question is, what time should they meet? Well, there are really only 2 candidates. If you think about the way we measure time, noon and midnight, those are the ones that have names of their own that seem unique, and noon is probably more practical for these purposes than midnight, and so they meet at noon, by the clock. And that's a shelling point. That is, at a point which is perceived by both of them as unique. And one of the important points about shelling points, I don't remember if Schelling emphasizes this or not, is that the existence of a shelling point is a subjective fact, not an objective fact. That for me, Chicago is Hyde Park Kenwood, the University of Chicago area. So if I was meeting somewhere in Chicago, I would tend to think about what's a particularly unique point there, maybe Rockefeller Chapel or something like that. For somebody for whom Chicago is the Indian district on Devon, well north of the downtown, there might well be some place like that that to him, provided the person he was meeting with had the same background, would seem unique. So the existence of a shelling point is a subjective fact, depends basically on how the two people organize the world, how they see things classified, and therefore how they can find a common unique item. And as I'm going to argue in a few minutes, it actually has real-world effects, and therefore a case where by changing the sort of invisible, immaterial, subjective fact, you can actually change the world. Let me take the example I've got up there, which is in my paper. I am now imagining 2 people, each of whom is separately given that list of numbers, and to save all the trouble of going into New York City, all they have to do is to independently, simultaneously pick the same number. And if you think about it, what the answer is depends a whole lot on the people. That for sort of an ordinary non-mathematical type, probably the number that looks most unique is 100. It's got this 1 and 2 zeros. Sort of, I don't know, to my eye it looks more unique. Mathematician will say, well, 100, yeah, but 100 is a perfect square. 9 is a perfect square. 25 is a perfect square. So there are 3 of them. We can't coordinate on perfect squares. Primes, my memory is I've got 3 primes up there. I won't check which ones they are, but 5 is a prime. I think 73 is a prime. I don't remember if one of the others is. Maybe we only got 2. So that doesn't work. But of course, for mathematicians, it's easy. The universe of numbers only contains 1 even prime. And there it is, 2. The only even prime. So the mathematicians will coordinate on that. Somebody who is illiterate in this language, to whom these are just patterns and not numbers, might well, especially if I draw my 69 with a slightly more curved 9, say, aha, that's got an interesting kind of symmetry. Turn it upside down, it looks exactly the same. That's the unique one. So what that suggests is that what the answer to the question, what do you coordinate on, is, depends on how you have organized the world in your head and will be in principle different for different people. Now, why is this interesting? We don't very often have the problem of meeting at a particular place at a particular time without communicating. It's just bridge players do. I have this theory that each of the really successful games is training for some particular kind of real-world problem, and what bridge is really about is coordinating without communication, as any serious bridge player I think will realize. But in any case, I want to argue that it's important for an entirely different kind of problem, and that's strategic bargaining. And that the reason it's important is that when you are engaged in strategic bargaining with somebody, you can talk all you like, but none of the talk is believable. So if my sort of standard example is the 2 bank robbers who've made it away. They figure they've got maybe 15 minutes before the cops arrive. They want to separate out. How do they split up the loot? And each of them will plausibly believe that he did more than half the work. Given that each of us is a biased judge in his own case. So each of them will say, I should get at least 65% of it. Each of them, however, will realize that when the other says, I'm not going to get out of here, I don't get 65%, he's probably lying. Because each of them has an obvious incentive to claim as large a part of their, as large a share as possible, even if he's not really willing to stand up for it. So how do they solve it? They want to find some offer which they will both see as unique and which will therefore result in their dividing up a loot and running for it rather than somebody proposing another offer and keeping on arguing until the cops arrive. And the obvious division to most of us would be 50-50 split. That's a Shelley point. And the game involved is the game probably most of you know is bilateral monopoly. Bilateral monopoly traditionally is you and I have a dollar to split between us if and only if we can agree on the division. The game nicely sort of illustrates the perverse logic of sort of strategic bargaining and game theory. Because if I really believe that you won't accept anything less than 99 cents of the dollar, I would fold because I'd say a penny is better than nothing. If you really believe I won't accept less than 99 cents, you will fold for the same reason. And so we've got this problem where each of us wants to pretend to be greedier than he is, as it were, but each of us is skeptical about the claim. And again, under many circumstances, you're going to end up with a 50-50 split. Now, again, it depends on subjective facts. The point I make in the article is you could imagine people who had been brought up in a culture where everybody was a utilitarian, where it was taken for granted that marginal utility of income is inverse to wealth, and therefore where if anybody started to think about a 50-50 split, it would be perfectly obvious that a 50-50 split meant a 50-50 split of utility, not a 50-50 split of money. What does money matter? It's just sort of a minor intermediate that just confuses us. And the 50-50 split of utility means a division of the money proportional to our wealth. And then, of course, you see the problem, which is that if we're a little bit less certain about utilitarianism, the wealthier person makes a few comments about how utility is what really matters and money doesn't in an attempt to force the selling point to the one he prefers instead of the other one. What the point suggests is that in a bargaining situation, you, as it were, can talk but can't communicate. This reminds me of the Tom Lehrer routine, some of you know, where he's complaining about all these modern literature about people who can't communicate with each other. If people can't communicate with each other, can't they at least shut up? All right, so let me now get back to my dispute with Gordon Tullock. In the course of an article in, I think, the second of two books on sort of the economics of anarchy broadly defined, he's thinking about whether you could imagine people who start out in a Hobbesian world bargaining up from that to a state of order, bargaining to agree on what their rights are and what they'll do and so forth. And he says, well, obviously that's impossible. Why is it impossible? Because what does the bargain mean? It means I will agree to the following contract. I will agree that that's yours and this is mine. But there's no government there to enforce the contract because we're in a Hobbesian state of nature. So therefore, words are fine, but the words will have no effect. There's no way we can get out of it by making agreements. That was the guts of his argument. And it's perfectly obvious that the argument is true, but in fact it's false. And that's the claim I want to make. And the way I make it is to imagine a two-person Hobbesian world, and both people realize that life will be much longer and nicer in all the ways that Hobbes says this world is, this life isn't, if they can agree on a set of property rights, agree on a division of the world. There's quite a lot of land there, so it's not a really tight division. And my claim is that what they are very likely to do is to observe some natural division, like a stream that's running through it, and say, here's the deal, everything north of the stream is yours, everything south of the stream is mine, will you agree? And they agree. And now the question is, why has that changed anything? And the answer is, it's changed anything because it's changed the selling points. Because now the strategy that I'm going to adopt is to be willing to go to quite a lot of trouble to punish you for crossing the stream without my permission. Why? Because the relevant selling point is enforce the rights agreed to. And the agreement has changed how we now organize the alternative. You are going to behave in the same way. There's no guarantee. I'm not claiming that all such contracts will be sufficiently self-enforced so that they will be held. But the claim I am making is that the contract itself increases the probability of its being kept because it gives each party an incentive a commitment strategy, as it were, to bear unreasonably large costs. Yeah?
Where's the commitment? I don't see it.
The commitment is that if I let you cross the stream routinely, I will, the division of property we had before won't work. I will have to sleep up in a tree for fear that you will come across, because you're used to coming across, and I don't try to stop you coming across, and if I don't spot you coming across, you'll brain me in order to avoid the risk that I will futurely brain you. That kind of division. The argument is that I am committing myself to a strategy of defining the rules we have just agreed to, that really by agreeing to them, I made that commitment. You made a similar symmetrical commitment. Doesn't make sense to you?
No, because you're still presupposing symmetry of power.
No, I'm... I am.
Because then, at each point in time, you're going to marginally assess what the costs and benefits are of committing. Pre-committing suggests, as you said, you're going to make reasonable or unreasonable attempts to enforce that contract. But that's the auxiliary assumption I'm not sure I understand.
All right. I'm assuming that the physical power of the two parties is not radically different. That is that if there is a fight to the death, neither of us knows for sure who's going to win. All right? It's clear that if you have enough superior power, we're not likely to end up with a symmetric agreement. But I don't have to show that all situations will lead to it. In order to answer Gordon's argument, I only have to show some will. And the claim now is that I say to myself, if I choose the wimp strategy, which is when he crosses, I back down, then we will be back in this unpleasant Hobbesian world. If I choose the strategy of when he crosses, I fight him as hard as I can, he will recognize, because of the contract we've made, that I'm only fighting him as hard as I can on my side of the stream, and indeed he will realize that I will realize that if he retreats across the stream, now he's the one committed to fight as hard as he can, that each of us knows that if he drops the commitment and backs down, now he no longer can, to any significant degree, rely on the other person staying on his side of the stream and is therefore in a more dangerous and poorer world. Is that? You don't see it. All right, let me keep going and see if I can persuade you. I want to now take the second step in this, because so far the original contract was just for an initial definition of property rights. But I want to claim that the same logic also implies that future contracts are to some degree self-enforcing. So the second step in the argument is 20 years later, and Norris, the gentleman with the northern half of the world, has planted an orchard of our apple trees, which have now grown up in the 20 years and are bearing fruit. But unfortunately, while he wasn't watching, as it were, an oak tree also grew up and is shading his orchard and thus reducing its output. On the other hand, Southey, his neighbor to the south, for other and unrelated reasons, has developed the technology of flint knapping, has created a flint axe, and has been using it for his own purposes to cut down trees for his own use. And so Norris goes to Southey and says, I've got a deal I'd like to propose. I want you to cut down that oak tree because it's going to be really hard for me to do it without an axe. And in exchange, I will give you 40 apples each year when my trees bear apples. And Southey agrees to that and cuts down the oak tree. And now the question is there any reason, first, is there any reason for Norris to keep his agreement to actually deliver the apples? And if there is a reason, namely the fear that if he doesn't, the next time he's out of sight, Southey will cross the stream for just long enough to cut down a few apple trees in revenge, why doesn't that work just as well as a threat by Southey before they make the contract? That is, you could see that if Southey wants his 40 apples a year, once the contract is made, he could say, if you break the contract, I will punish you in this way. But if there had been no contract and he never done any work, he could also have said, if you don't pay me tribute of 40 apples each year, I will, at some point when I'm pretty sure you're not in sight, sneak across and cut down some of your apple trees. And my claim is that the contract increases the chance both of Norris doing what he's agreed to do and of Southey punishing him if he doesn't. And again, the argument is we've established a new shelling point. That the shelling point now in our strategic game, the equivalent of the 50-50 split, is keep your agreements. And that on the other hand, we already established our original shelling point by dividing up the land. So if Southey proposes a threat, if Southey tries to engage in extortion, Norris will say to himself, if I give in to this extortion, there is no particular limit to how far it will go. I will keep losing things to Southey every time he's feeling like he wants something. My selling point is to enforce our original division at the streamline, and therefore I should be willing, as long as the costs aren't too horrendously high, to fight to keep that, and therefore to refuse his extortionist demand. Yeah?
You're presupposing a stable equilibrium. I thought there's the well-known work called the game theory. It says if you have several players, you have a multiplayer game, and you have a multiplayer game in which, say, an agreement is reached, but that agreement is not stable, so you have people constantly defecting. You never have a stable agreement, which you have no supportive agreement, because every equilibrium that's obtained by having, say, a majority agreed something.
You're now talking about three-person majority vote in von Neumann.
But it doesn't have a majority vote, right? You think about fighting, actually involving majority.
That is to begin with, I was limiting my presentation to a two-party example, which I thought was sufficient to make the point that a contract can be self-enforcing, and getting to many people, in some sense I will be doing later, but at the level of our primitive bargaining up out from anarchy, it seems to me two people are enough to make my argument. If you imagine more people, you're then going to have to think about what coalition arrangements represent selling points, at what point my defecting from my previous agreement is going to be to result in not having a selling point that I am happy with to live with. So now my claim is that not only is the initial contract dividing up the world to some degree self-enforcing, but that contracts made later are to some degree self-enforcing, because now the alternatives that we're choosing among are seen not as do I give him 40 apples or do I not give him 40 apples, but do I enforce the property right rule we agreed to or not, and I expect him, just as he expects me, to be relatively willing to back down over that rule, just as my two bank robbers, even though they both like 60%, are relatively willing to back down to 50%, because both of them see that as the available selling point. Let me go on to discuss the same issue in the modern world in a couple of different hypotheticals. And I want to... Yeah?
You're throwing so far aside, but it seems like you make a lot stronger just by bringing in the psychological work of the down effects, which basically says that once you make an agreement, then each person will, as a result of the data agreement,
I understand. That's
affairs. And then, during the both sides, expect the person who's been trampled on will care more about the person who's been trampling, and then decide that's the direction.
I actually made the argument in the opposite direction. My explanation of the endowment effect is that it's an evolutionary result of the fact that if people value their property because it's their property more than others, that provides a solution to the problem of enforcing property rights in a world without a state or without external enforcement mechanisms. So, well, except that so far I've been talking about an us a very long time ago, bargaining up to things, and so I don't know if I can assume psychological characteristics which I'm claiming evolved to solve that problem. I was going to get to animals, yes. Animals, in fact, behave in just the way I'm describing. It's called territorial behavior.
Just one more thing. Yep. I don't understand what the issue with selling point is, because in the literature I know about the role of the state, there's no doubt that there's two-party self-enforcement agreements. So, for instance, take Yule and Rogoff. Yule and Rogoff's paper is all about how that should have self-enforcement to do that, how you can have somewhat land to another country, but there's no enforceable agreements. But under certain conditions, the expectation about future bargains
But that kind of argument all depends on the selling point, because the question is, why don't I believe that a strategy of default this time and keep your contracts forever after is just as plausible as a strategy of always keep your contracts? And the answer is, it seems to me, that the way our minds organize the strategic alternatives, we see always keep your contracts as a unique outcome, and default on the first contract and keep it thereafter mixes up with default on the first two, default on the first and the third, default on the sixth, second, and the fifth. So it's only because we see as consistent behavior And that's real, I'm arguing, at least it's really a matter of how we have organized the alternatives in our heads. That's why I'm claiming it's a selling point argument that what you were saying works. Otherwise, you'd default the first time, and then people are perfectly willing to lend you again because they're just as willing to believe that from now on you won't.
But now you're getting into the literature of common knowledge, which they're now you're sort of asking the question, does common knowledge exist? And your selling point is your example of the kind of common knowledge story.
But my point is that the reason why it matters that you and I organize things in the same way is precisely because it creates a selling point and therefore solves what's ultimately a bilateral monopoly bargain. Yeah?
I think you can make a distinction between some of the stuff that you're talking about as a folk theorem, as a result that John is talking about, with a slightly different example. Suppose somebody comes to Norris and Sethi and says, I know 2,000 years ago your ancestor promised to give his ancestor 40 bushels of apples every month.
And 40 apples.
40 apples, whatever it happens to be.
Right.
And then he goes away. Right? I can see your story perhaps holding not quite as strongly, but also that could establish a selling point and an equilibrium, even though there's no prospect of gains at all there, the prospect of future gains.
But I would have said it's an equilibrium only because each of us believes that the other is willing to bear substantial costs to enforce his claims.
Right. The point of my example is to separate this out from the gains. Separate the selling point from the point of gains.
So like the folk theorem says, you know, it's the self-enforcing contracts. And is what you're saying that, the folk theorem says you have a multiplicity of different equilibrium. Of course, the one in which you have self-enforcing contracts is just one. And it's what you're saying that the same point of story tells us why this particular equilibrium supported by the folk theorem is the one that we can set.
I think that's a way of putting it. The point I was making before, that in pure logic, as it were, defect the first time and keep your contract ever after is just as much a possibility as always keep your contract. And it's only because all the players in this bilateral monopoly game see always keep your contract as unique and all the others as not, that it has at least some advantage, some reason why you're violating the contract once makes me think you're going to violate it again.
That's correct. But then the fact that, I mean, we already know that these contracts can be something more safe. I mean, the selling point can be consistent that there's a reason to accept why this equilibrium is one.
And in particular, why making the contract changes the situation. Yeah.
The other problem Alex is getting at is the common knowledge is on as well, the common knowledge is something. The selling point story seems to depend on this some kind of common knowledge. And it relates to the work, and I'm not particularly familiar with Robert Allman's work on agreeing to disagreeing and so on.
But it depends, I would have said, on people organizing their view of the world in the same way. So that one of the predictions that's going to come out of this is that conflict is especially likely on interfaces between cultural groups different enough so that what I see as the unique bargaining outcome, you see as my attempt to swindle you by pushing it further. So that's one implication of this way of thinking about it. Let me go on to two sort of modern versions of the argument. And the first is the Falklands War, that on the face of it, England was willing to pay very large costs in order to maintain its control over a bunch of more or less worthless islands with 126 people on them, or some such number. Now, I've seen some suggestions that people thought there might eventually be petroleum opportunities somewhere in the area near Falklands. I haven't seen that that's turned out to be right. Maybe it is, but I don't think you really need it to explain what was happening, that from the standpoint of England, if they backed down when Argentina invaded the Falklands, then who will believe that they won't back down if Spain decides they want Gibraltar? Or China wants Hong Kong? Well, that they did it, ultimately give in, but presumably because they didn't really want Hong Kong anymore, I presume. That's my guess, at least.
Well, they had a contract.
So the contract was for the there was a contract for the additional territory. Was all of Hong Kong? I guess you're right. All of Hong Kong expired. There had been an earlier one for the new territories, which expired. I think that's right. I was confused. You're right. So that does explain it. That's right. So the basic argument is that in that kind of international context, again, you will see as unique the strategy of defend my own. It doesn't mean you will bear an infinite cost to do it, that you will bear a larger cost than on the face of it that particular issue. She justifies because people have a view of consistency, which ultimately, as I say, is subjective. That you could imagine, for example, you know, there was this famous case of the Pope dividing South America between Portugal and Spain. You could certainly imagine a world where people accepted the importance of the Pope, where they would say the Pope could change the Schelling point, that the real unique outcome is do what the Pope says, not follow this river's division of the continent. So again, if you have real problems, if Spain had still been Muslim at that time and Portugal had respected the Pope's division and Spain hadn't. Let me take another example of what seems to be the same logic. I imagine that I am living in some suburb where the law enforcement is not very competent or energetic, and one day my neighbor happens to get into conversation with me and says, you know, I've been thinking that hauling my trash off to the trash dump is a real pain. And I think from now on, I'm just going to dump it over the fence onto your property. And you know and I know that trying to get the official authorities to do anything about it is going to be more trouble than it's worth for you. And you can take it to the dump along with your trash. But if you don't like that idea, I've got a deal. $10 a month and I won't do it. All right? I think all of us expect that offer will not be accepted. Even if, as is very likely, $10 a month is more than the cost, sorry, is less than the cost of the things I might do to fight you. Right? Imagine one possibility is you dump it and I just dump it into the trash. That's not very satisfactory either. Another possibility is that I sneak over at night and cut down your prized petunias, or I hire a lawyer to try to go after you. You can think of various ways in which I might fight you, which include both violence and using the legal system. But even if it is the case that all of those alternatives are more costly than paying you your $10 tribute, I still don't pay. And my claim is that the reason that I don't pay is, again, that the don't pay tribute, maintain property rights, is seen by me and I believe by you as a selling point. That you, therefore, will believe it when I make it clear that I'm going to fight you as hard as I have, and we'll probably back down. And if I do have to fight you as hard as I can, and it is costly, at least you won't make another such demand in the future. Other people, if they know about it, won't make such demands. And again, all of this depends on the pattern of consistent behavior, which itself is, I am claiming, a subjective, not an objective fact. Yes?
This is where I think Marx's point is relevant. Because you're blending two separate issues. You're blending whether it's a stable equilibrium. So there could be a multiplicity of equilibrium out of the boat there. But the selling point is saying why one particular equilibrium is going to be picked out.
Yes.
So you've known that, we already know in advance that equilibrium is sustainable. The issue is why do they stay there rather than move to another equilibrium that's equally sustainable.
I guess my claim would be that another one would be sustainable only if people organized the data in such a way that they saw falling off from that again as giving up the selling point. So the claim I now want to make is that this way of looking at it answers my first question, which is in what sense is an orderly society different from a Hobbesian state of nature? That from my standpoint, what an orderly society, a civic order, whatever you want to call it, has is a network of mutually consistent and mutually recognized commitment strategies. Or if you like, mutually recognized selling points. So that everybody knows that if he tries to extort $10 a month by threatening to injure me in ways that whether or not they can be prevented by the law, all of us see as violations of my property rights, I will almost certainly refuse and will be willing to go to a good deal of trouble against him. Whereas everybody also realizes that if I demand $10 a month from him and he turns it down, I won't take those actions. That is that everybody recognizes that everybody else has a set of commitment strategies, and as long as those strategies are consistent, and as long as we all perceive the same selling points, now my claim is we have an orderly society. And that's never going to work perfectly, of course, and it may break down on the margin, as it were, of places where people view the world differently, where some people don't think, take intellectual property as an obvious example, where to some people it does not seem, some people think that you're violating my copyright is like you're dumping trash on my lawn, and I should be willing to go to a good deal of trouble to stop you from doing it, whereas other people say, no, you're demanding to be paid for my making a copy of a book I already own, or a CD I already own. That's an extortion. That's like demanding the $10, and I should therefore resist that claim very strongly. So I think you get that kind of conflict in issues where people have different, I mean, you could call it different moral intuitions. I suppose I should go back, and I should have said at the beginning that the possible solutions to the puzzle of how you ever get out of the Hobbesian state of nature, one which I find very unpersuasive is it's a matter of physical objects, that it's because the police have police cars or uniforms or something. That seems unpersuasive. You can easily imagine a Hobbesian state of nature when things break down with all the physical stuff. The second one, which is plausible, but which I find less interesting, is that it's a moral difference, that the reason you have an orderly society is a set of moral beliefs, so that most people don't want to violate other people's property rights because they think that would be wrong to do. That's a possible explanation. But the one I find more interesting is that what you have added to the Hobbesian world is this massive set of mutually recognized selling points that I'm a wimp if I pay you even 10 cents of tribute, but I am not a wimp if I fail to insist on extorting tribute from you. And wimp I'm now thinking as a strategic concept, sort of think of it like hawk dove equilibrium or something of that sort, somebody who does not maintain his wimp strategies. Now, I now want to claim that I now have a solution to my second puzzle, which is what is the state? And when I tried to answer that question a very long time ago, writing Machinery of Freedom, the answer I came up with was that a government is an agency of legitimized coercion. And I then tried to explain that I was using both legitimized and coercion in special senses, that coercion was not really a moral category. Coercion was really a description of what people in that society saw as actions that done by other people in that society violated their rights. And that legitimized wasn't a moral category. It didn't mean that people think it's legitimate or that it is legitimate. It means that people do not respond in that society to those violations in the way in which routinely they would respond to private violations. So that I can now, this way of thinking about it, sort of fill in the blanks in that and say that what is going on is that we have in a society a set of mutually perceived selling point commitment strategies, etc., where the state is that organization against which we drop the commitment strategies. That essentially, in dealing with everybody else in the society, it is true that against overwhelming force I might surrender, but that in dealing with everyone else in the society, I am willing to bear costs much larger than what seems to be at stake in order to maintain what I see as my rights or my claims. And that with regard to the state, I am not willing to do that. That when the IRS informs me they've frozen my bank account, I don't go yelling down the street, yelling, stop thief, nor do I try to do the sort of whatever equivalent things one could try to do against the state. I say, well, that's too bad. They shouldn't have done that. They're in the wrong. I'm an anarchist. I don't believe in all this taxation nonsense. But as a matter of fact, I have long ago sort of turned the psychological switch in my head, which says, that's a pity, but that's not something you're going to fight over. Whereas when the private thief breaks in and steals stuff, even though I realize that chasing him down the street is quite likely to get me hurt because he may well have a gun or a knife or just be tougher than I am, still, until it's really clear, until the point where he actually pulls out the gun and points it at me, I am willing to bear what seem like unreasonably large costs to keep somebody from getting away with stealing from me. So it's a fairly straightforward argument. It's an argument which I originated, as I say, back in response to Tullock's piece in the mid-70s or so, and which still seems to me to give a intuitively useful answer to both of those interesting questions. Yes.
So the, I know this is that the issue here is there's multiple equilibria.
Yes.
Multiple equilibria is another way of saying it's incomplete theory.
Yes.
Psychology must, in some ways, open up the details. You could probably say that there was some group selection in the past that selected us for having certain psychology that picked certain equilibria.
Yes.
And that there wouldn't be much personal penalty for group selection that just picked equilibria.
Yes.
But now if we say the state is a certain kind of thing where our psychology is such that we don't persist, the key question is then, is the state an ancient concept that was evolved in our personal psychology, or is the state
So here's your question, because presumably even in the pre-state world there are other things that have that category. We probably drop back to the strategy against bears, for example. We probably drop it against thunderstorms, so that there are things that we don't think of as our peers, as it were. And in fact, let me go back to the point that I think Ryan or somebody made, that the same pattern I'm describing is a pre-human pattern. Because we know about territorial behavior in animals, and we know that, I think we know, that territorial behavior in animals, again, the critical point is a commitment strategy. The critical point is that whatever switch they turn in their brain, you have two animals of the same species, sometimes it has to be the same sex, not radically different in ability to hurt each other. One of them has somehow claimed a territory, and that means that if the territory is invaded by the other, he will fight more and more desperately the farther in he gets. Both of them know that a fight to the death is a loss for both. And once the first one has succeeded in committing himself, now the second one usually backs down. So that strategy does not apply to members of other species. That is, the normal observation is that among birds or fishes, which are the two kinds that most often have territorial behavior, they don't object to trespass by other species, only by their own species. So it may be, if you want to do the sort of evolutionary biology story, which I agree is certainly an attractive story, you say, well, similarly, the state is fitted into the niche of not a person, not a human, for whatever reason.
Would we really not resist them?
I don't know. The question, I guess, is not would we resist them, but how fiercely would we resist them? That none of this implies that you won't pay $10 for an $11 benefit. It's that you're willing to pay $100 for what appears to be an $11 benefit. That's the puzzle. But it might also depend on how we classify the alien. If you think about aliens in science fiction, a lot of the aliens in science fiction are thought of as people. On the other hand, I don't know if you know, Cherry has this series, Pride of Chanur, I think was the first one, and it's set in a world where there are a bunch of oxygen-breathing intelligent species which more or less interact with each other as people, although there are a lot of problems because they're quite different from each other. But then there are one or two other species where you are marginally able to agree on traffic rules, so to speak, because they are so different. And when you attempt to translate their speech, you're getting these four different lines going on at once, and they're sort of very, very non-human, and presumably those you're not going to. It would be sort of foolish to say, well, you know, they crashed our space station, so we're going to punish them. And they didn't know it was our space station. They didn't know it was crashing. I mean, who knows what they knew? So I think it would depend a lot on whether the aliens were seen as humans look funny or were seen as very different. But the other thing is that one could imagine, suppose we have Superman, a not very nice Superman. You could certainly imagine that after enough bruising collisions, people will somehow manage to modify their psychology. They'll manage to say, well, yes, commitment strategies apply, but they don't apply against Superman. I mean, let's not be silly about this. So I really find it hard in a lot of these things to distinguish arguments that hinge on evolutionary biology from arguments that hinge on parental indoctrination or arguments that hinge on individual sort of self-programming. And I guess I really am more interested in the logic of the problem, and it gives arguments for any of those working. Yes?
So I need to be pedantic about this, but this is where I think the language you gave is very useful. I really think you're confusing equilibrium with selling point, and now you're using commitment strategy, which is something else entirely. it's worthwhile to think about the Bayesian game theory story. In the prisoner's dilemma, no commitment is needed to end up with a Nash equilibrium. The problem is the Nash equilibrium in the prisoner's dilemma is not very optimal, right? And so in that case, there's no commitment, and you end up in a Nash equilibrium. Now what happens is the second point, as Mark pointed out,
it's more than a Nash equilibrium, of course.
You have multiple Nash equilibria. And then the shutting point helps you pick a Nash equilibrium. But in fact, you're proposing something that's neither Nash nor shutting. That is, you're sort of saying, if we go back to the prisoner's dilemma game, if, for instance, lying is the equivalent of defecting in the prisoner's dilemma game, and telling the truth is the cooperative solution, then the commitment strategy is one. Is, let's say you raise your pitch that no matter what, they'll tell the truth. That's a commitment strategy that gets you out of the prisoner's dilemma box. So it's a little bit, the equivalent of this is the chicken game, where either you're driving each other, you're playing your chicken. If you chain yourself to the car, so that in such a way that you can't support...
And the other person can see that you've changed yourself.
You chain yourself. Then that's the commitment strategy.
Again, you break off the brake pedal and throw it out the window.
Exactly. But that's no longer, that's neither selling nor Nash. That's changing the Nash equilibrium, precisely by engaging what would be ex ante, either a rational strategy or extending the game. So this is why you're concerned saying, and so we have disagreements. But very often these agreements, I'm still not sure whether the contracts we're talking about need to be selling, or are they merely...
I'm claiming that the contract changes the selling point. The contract creates a selling point because there is now a new selling point which consists of keep the contract that didn't exist before we made the contract.
There's no need to selling point if it's a dominant strategy in Nash equilibrium. There's no selling point relevant. It's a dominant strategy in Nash equilibrium. The selling points are about situations in which there's non-unenforceability, non-commitment, and you're picking from multiple equilibrium.
But what I'm arguing is that if you think about the game of, do you agree that in bilateral monopoly, that when I insist on 50%, that is more believable than when I insist on 60%.
Yeah.
If not for a selling point, why?
Yes, I understand that. But now to commit to that is something different, right? Because commit, so to say, I am now going to pay a price for you to violate.
But I would like, if I could, to commit to demanding 70 cents if I could make you believe it out of the dollar. I don't have any mechanism to do that.
But you gave me an example of the person throwing garbage over, and you're sort of saying somebody would, in fact, bear, under certain conditions, they would bear a price to get rid of you beyond the price of just making, you know, making stuff.
And what I'm saying is that the selling point at that point is respect existing property rights, and that because it is a selling point, therefore people are willing... That, as it were, creates the commitment because I realize that if I act to maintain that position, the benefits are much larger than if I acted to maintain the never pay more than $5 tribute option. But if it weren't for the fact that both I and my opponent organize the world in such a way that pay nothing is seen as more unique than pay only $5, there'd be no reason to expect that I had a reason to stop it at zero instead of stopping at $5. Does that make sense to you?
But that's not a selling point. That's all. You're just misusing the term. I'm sorry.
It is a selling point because it depends on the uniqueness of not paying of zero. Right? Yes?
You probably already thought of this, David, but it's just interesting to apply these ideas to black markets. So, for example, why is it that you actually lose a drug dealer's drugs and he says you have to go and find $1 million to do that? That seems credible, but if a drug dealer shows up with $1 million, it doesn't seem credible.
Yeah.
The location appears and cost is the same.
Yeah. No, I agree. That would be... And again, all of these, you can try to make it a moral argument. You can try to say that my sort of self-regard depends on my not letting you cheat me out of $1 million kind of thing. But it seems to me it's much more interesting if you can make a strategic argument where there is a reason why I want to have a self-regard which makes me feel badly about losing the million when you took it from me, but not when you declined to give it to me, so to speak. Yes, Mark.
But, so if there's 13 there, all terms with 13 should figure out why you would be not a selling point. You know, or 13 should be the number that is a
selling point. Well, then 13 would be a selling point.
Would be a selling point in what?
No, because it's the only, it's the only unique, it would then be the only unique number.
Yeah.
Yeah, but being a selling point is a statement about uniqueness, not about evilness. What? Yeah, it seems to me that your negative selling point, that sort of the point of this, is that it isn't that the under the clock at Grand Central Station at noon is a better place than some other place you could meet. What's special about it is its uniqueness. Yes?
So I think I'm hopping on to the point of conversating as well. But the terminology is really important here.
What?
The terminology we use.
Yes.
Like a game. So coordination in New York is a coordination game.
Yes.
Whereas the story you're giving is a business dilemma, where, well, not necessarily the same.
It's a bilateral monopoly. My claim is, that was sort of my initial point, that the shelling point originates the coordination game, and it then becomes an explanation to a bargaining game, to bilateral monopoly, for example, because of the fact that in the bilateral monopoly situation, you can't make believable statements, because everybody knows that it pays both of you to lie, and therefore you can't communicate, and yet you've got to find something to agree on, because the cops are showing up in another 10 minutes, and therefore you are just like Schelling's people who've got to find themselves in a wilderness or something and find the branch of the stream because that's the unique point on the map. Yeah?
Well, all the problems I'm having, but in a sense, all this stuff seems really familiar, but it seems like something being very slow, just using different terminology. So, I mean, a less sparkling game, 50-50 is the result of the bench, for the reasons that Schelling said. So I'm not sure what your confusion is there. Whereas I think there is a contribution, or I think more surprising than the same from the selected equilibrium, which is the name that's being followed with the same. Even though I think Hegel is slaves as well.
That is the initial, the first agreement among my two people in the state of nature depended on a shelling point defined by the stream. And but that again is a bilateral monopoly bargaining. I could have asked for the stream plus 15 feet. You could have asked for the stream plus 15 feet. Why is it that we both see that the place to stop arguing is the stream? And it seems to me that the answer is because it's a shelling point. It is really central to my argument to claim that the shelling point explains bargaining outcomes because they require a kind of coordination without communication, just as it explains the ordinary coordination without communication story. And I think, though I'm not sure that that's in Schelling's original essay, but it's a long, long time since I read that article. Yes?
But then your example of Falklands is a bit strange, because your example about how the shelling point is necessary to generate the digital contract, but the whole point about many of these cases is that there's an endowment issue. Imagine that the contract begins, which is not the right of the shelling point.
Yes.
The right of force or exogenous shock.
Yes.
Now to call any future agreement based on that contract tied to the shelling point seems to me to be almost irrelevant.
But the shelling point is the contract. The shelling point, the point is that you are seeing the question as, do I or don't I enforce my contractual rights, not as, do I or don't I get X number of apples from you. Going back, what happened in Falklands, of course, I think what happened in Falklands, was that the method didn't work because the Argentines had a different opinion than the British about whose property the Falklands were. And you therefore ended up with a war in which both sides were spending more than the amount than the stakes were worth. And it seems to me that what's going on is that each side, that this is my earlier point about what happens on cultural interfaces, that each side saw it as, in order not to persuade everybody who watches us that we're a pushover, we have to defend our rights. And that, again, depends on the fact that each of them sees the unique outcome as the one defined by their perception of rights. Yes, Brian. Yes.
Yeah. First of all, it's quite possible that more principles can tell you the whole range of options are legitimate. And then you get rid of that range, then you're left with a very small number, and you are closing this.
Sure.
Even if there's only one thing that is uniquely evil, like the number of those things uniquely evil, just the fact that selling points has to find something unique, you can be in the process of elimination. We'll never be 13, we'll never be these other things.
That is obviously moral beliefs might change what is the set of alternatives you're choosing among, and it might be that if there were two alternatives, which by however you classified it, looked sort of equally unique, but one of them you can't consider because that'd be immoral, then that would get you to the other. But it just seems to me that you don't need that, as it were. That you don't need any morals at all, is my claim, in order to have an explanation of...
I'm saying you don't need that in the real world that's often important.
Oh, it might very well be, sure. I'm not trying to give a full description of the real world. Also, and there are other things that are important. One of the points I've made elsewhere is that another thing that's important is what I think of as natural property, whereas natural property is the fact that it is much cheaper for me to move my arm than for you to move my arm. It is much... My gun belongs to me because I know where it's hidden and you don't. So there's a whole bunch of sort of things where it's a technology, where one person can control something more easily than another, and you can imagine bargaining up from those things. If I went back to my initial point and say, all right, well, given that we've got a bunch of natural property, we can now make deals for all the unnatural property and defend it in some sense by the use of our natural property. I mean, there are lots of more things one can say, but it seemed to me that just seeing the way in which looking at bargaining through a selling point lens, as it were, helps explain both why contracts are self-enforcing and which, again, it seems to me that you don't get without that because of the problem of how do you distinguish between always keeping it and keeping it after the first time. And at the same time, also gives what seems to me is a plausible answer to what's special about the state. Yes, Mark.
Sorry to keep on.
Yeah. Quite all right.
I don't think the whole thing in some dollars is explained by my actual monopoly. I don't see that as a relevant problem. I see it as Christmas dilemma. I don't think this bargaining story explains what we think of as being in the hot seat jungle. This is going to buy something up. And it seems surprising that we would divide it up 50-50 in many cases. It seems pretty obvious that the selling point would be what would determine the bargaining situation. The situation in the hot seat jungle is the fact that somebody can detect after the fact that we had a repeated interaction and then we're back to the standard prisoner's dilemma story. And I think the reason I was going to continue is to keep on moving between coordination games, again, examples, it seems to be prisoner's dilemmas, like the Ultimate example.
Right.
I think you're exactly right. The really big possibility is really describing not the idea of what we call a broken game or the very hopped up game, which is actually isomorphic. Like in Hobson's story, just the fact that when you are aggressing someone, there's a chance you're going to wind up getting killed by a person who would have left you alone otherwise, means that there is a worse outcome than fighting. Whereas in really business dilemma, then fighting wouldn't serve you up. Hobbs talks to this prisoner's dilemma that the scenario you set up actually is much more like a knockout game, which is exactly the same as a natural organic game when you look at the other ones.
So then the next equilibrium, what are the next equilibrium? Is clockwise, or dove.
There's an actual remember hawk dove involves some hawks and some doves. Yes.
Robert. So supposing this is a theory of the state.
Yes.
But it seems like it doesn't answer very many of the questions we might have about the state. So I guess the question is what would you add more? So you say, well, there's an agency that we don't feel like retaliating against.
Yes.
Right. But now the question is why is only one of them? Why did you think about monopoly force, et cetera, et cetera?
Lots of other questions one could ask. But, you know, this goes back to the question of who is or isn't an anarchist, which is a question that if you think you are an anarchist, you get asked a good deal. And there is a very common line of argument one runs into, which says, well, you're not really an anarchist at all. You are in favor of having some mechanism by which force is used in order to punish people who break the rules. Therefore, that's a government. And I don't think that's a government. As I say, if I think about how we actually sort of intuitively describe some things as governments and some things as not, we don't think of a guy who fights back when you try to grab his wallet as being a government. And therefore, I wanted to see, could I come up simply with a conceptual answer to why are my private rights enforcement agencies not governments, and yet why is the U.S. government a government? And the answer is because the private rights enforcement agencies don't claim and don't accept, have people accept the claim that they can do things that ordinary people can't do. so that they aren't in the position that a government is, where the government says, here are things I can do that you would retaliate against if anybody else did, but you aren't going to retaliate against what we do.
Right, but a hunger storm meets your current definition of government. Obviously, we need to add more conditions, right? You can't just be something that you don't retaliate against.
Yes, I agree that it is a organ, as we normally use it, not a